Welcome to Neo Bohemia. I'm your host, Charlie Layton. Today I will be talking a little bit about the subject of awe, what it's like to experience awe both as an artist making art and an audience member receiving the art. I'll talk about the elements that make us awestruck when we see a very moving piece of art or performance, and examine how we can allow more of those moments to happen. Awe is defined as an overwhelming feeling of reverence, admiration, or fear produced by that which is grand, sublime, or extremely powerful. It's important to note that in life we may feel awe in nature or in a spiritual or philosophical moment, or maybe when pondering the immense expanse of the universe or even the concept of God, but when we feel a sense of awe from humanity, one that is deliberate and intended to be received as such, and not the byproduct of some great work or deed, that sense of awe comes largely from the expression of art. It's true. I was trying to think of some exceptions, and a notable one was war, as in shock and awe, for example. Also, religion, but very often that experience can be actually artistic, too. And in the purely artistic context, I want to talk about awe as the experience of humility or admiration from witnessing a thing, seeing the work up front, or hearing the performance live, beholding in the senses someone else's creation, maybe even your own, actually, and feeling its power. Personally, I love to feel awe from art. I love to be in awe of an artist, and I must confess, it does not happen nearly enough for me. And that's sad to think that I wait for an experience that comes by rarely. But when it does, it can be spectacular, and I'm struck. And I can go for weeks, maybe even months, till my next hit. Maybe it was easier for me when I was a kid. The first performer who I ever really felt awe towards was my brother Tommy. At an early age, he was my truest artistic role model, aside from Weird Al, and the reason I wanted to be anything, really. At a crucial time in my development, I looked up to him and I just wanted to be like him, to be bold and expressive. He was exceptionally talented in high school drama. I was still in elementary school, but any plays I got to see him do inspired me. He played Danny Zuko in Grease and Riff in West Side Story, and drama department budgets being what they usually are, I'm pretty sure he wore the same costume for both roles. 90s jeans and an oversized white t-shirt with the sleeves rolled up. And he adapted the movie Soap Dish for the stage, directed it, and also starred as Kevin Kline's character, Jeffrey Anderson. And before you even cast a shadow of a doubt, I'm telling you right now, it worked. Somehow, it absolutely worked. It killed with high school students. Who knew? Before I wanted to become any kind of artist, I was just observing people in my young, small life and what they did. Maybe I admired Tommy because he was right there in front of me, but he demonstrated the kind of life I wanted to lead. I wanted the attention he was able to command as a performer, especially as the oldest boy in a family of six. I wanted to make everyone laugh the way he did. Also, he was, and still is, an exceptional impersonator, better than me in many ways, and the thing that makes it special is, instead of the typical SNL-type impersonations, he mostly does our close friends and family members with precision, detail, and confidence that I can only strive for. And add to that a couple of decades worth of movie quotes, Simpsons references, and inside jokes, and you've got a solid, inspiring older brother who made me jealous at first, but ultimately helped me reach where and who I am today. But I do think it's easier to experience awe as a child. Sure. I mean, if you can imagine what it was like before you were 9 or 10, if you saw the circus or a concert or a movie or even just a talent show with the big kids in it, pretty much anything loud or big or remotely scary or sad or funny had a profound effect on you at the time, if for no other reason than that you didn't have enough other experiences by which to compare it. And childlike awe is some of the best kind because it's just simple and pure and innocent, and a kid's sense of optimism and belief in magic is so much more conducive to that wonderment. And you can't just say it's because they don't know any better. And yes, that's partly true, but I think it's more than that because when you're young, your imagination and potential can go anywhere, and reality doesn't get in the way. And if you turn that sort of mindset onto art, the results can be amazing. Just think of the stuff you drew in school between recess and science. Though the work itself may not have been very skillful, the effect it had on you and your imagination must have been quite impressive at the time. Now, as you get older, that's a different story. It's harder to impress someone who's seen everything, but if you do, the experience carries with it much more magnitude and depth, and then you can experience awe with much more emotional and intellectual capacity and a deeper sense of time and life. It's ironic, too, because as I get older, I notice sometimes that the simpler, smaller, quieter things in art amaze me more than the big, loud, and shiny. Or especially an artist's acute sensitivity to those subtleties. Just look at Anton Chekhov, George Eliot, John Singer Sargent, or Miles Davis in 1948. And I'd like to believe that I'm still growing as a person, still allowing myself to stay open to the awesome and the profound, and that I'm developing the ability to truly comprehend it all, large and minute. Personally, I'm still trying to wrap my brain around the fact that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, and if you told me that as a kid, my brain could probably only hold on to the 4.5 and not the billion. Similarly, if you're an artist watching another artist, that can be challenging sometimes, especially if they're good. It's bittersweet. You can witness a friend or a peer who started out similar to you and watch their career go to other places, maybe even further and farther, or maybe just to a different stage in life than where you are, and that's perfectly fine. And if they do something that amazes you, there's often the first reaction of amazement, but then it can be followed rather quickly by the flood of jealousy, competitiveness, resentment, and then self-loathing, etc., etc. And all the thoughts of, what did they do differently that worked? Why wasn't that me? Why am I, by comparison, such a failure? Maybe they just had more money, resources, support from their friends and family, privilege, etc. Followed by, I never wanted what they have anyway. Or, maybe it wasn't that good. And that last one is a killer, I think. I've seen that, and I think it's nasty. If you resent an artist's work to the point that you denigrate the quality of their work just to make yourself feel better, I say that's kind of dangerous because you are in fact denying yourself your first response of awe. And sadly, people have to justify their negative reviews sometimes to the point of cognitive dissonance, so that your perceptions are just too biased to be trustworthy, that your agenda in what is good art becomes out of touch, and then the world is just going to go on without you. All because something threatens you or your sense of self. So if you are doing that, please stop. Try to be generous and fair. Be honest, too. How much more liberating would it be to say, I hate how good she is, rather than, she's not good, if in fact you know that she is. At least then you would say two simultaneous truths, as opposed to one lie to yourself and everyone else. And yeah, it sometimes stings to see awe-inspiring work that is not your own. Sometimes you are a passive witness to someone else's magnificence, and a lot of people don't have the generosity of spirit to allow that to exist in their minds and hearts, so they shut it out. They only see the flaws, or they malign the artist's message. They crap all over it and pretend the smell isn't theirs. But here's the trade-off. In order to feel awe for a work and have a rich, lively experience, you will have to make yourself open to it. You will have to allow yourself to feel and experience it, and any great piece of art will make an audience vulnerable in this process. Some people don't like that at all. They don't want to feel vulnerable. They don't want a connection through any artistic medium, and how odd and wonderful it is, especially when something moves you and you don't know why, like music without words, or abstract art, or modern dance, for example. But some people don't want to be challenged, even if that challenge is simply the acknowledgement of the artist's existence. I exist, I'm singing now, I'm dancing on the subway, I made this mural, I'm talking here. See me and hear what I have to say. And what I think makes people resistant to opening up to an artist's work, aside from maybe having feelings about it, is the possibility that the experience might actually humble them. Good art has the power to break down a person's defenses and commune with him or her. with invitations or confrontations. And a person who is too proud doesn't want to be met on a plane of existence that makes him feel like an equal or even a lesser, because then he or she might have to come down in his or her own estimation just to commune. But if you are too proud to enjoy another person's art, then you're going to miss out on all the fun. I promise you. Communion with an artist or a performer isn't all about you. Try some generosity and share in the experience, and you'll thank yourself later. Another way I've found that helps you experience awe in art is to learn to appreciate what goes into it and what people sacrifice to make it. Aside from money, resources, livelihood, time, effort, sometimes their sanity, people have given so much of their lives to try to express themselves as best they can, and too often that's taken for granted. There's been a movement in the world called mindful eating, in which we are all encouraged to eat more slowly, to savor the food, to shut out other distractions so that we can focus and enjoy it, to learn about it, and to appreciate where the food comes from. I think the same could be said for how we watch and listen to art and performance. Being a mindful audience member, particularly in performance when people's attention needs to be focused. So I've prepared a little PSA. I hope you enjoy it. How to be an audience member. Getting the most out of your audience experience can be easy and fun if you follow these simple instructions. Number one, show up to the performance if you say you will. Yes, it seems easy enough, but many patrons of the performative arts miss this simple yet crucial first step. Did you say you were going to see your friends play? Did you click going to the local band's Facebook event? Well, actually showing up can guarantee that you will be an audience member to an otherwise unattended performance. And most performers really do love having an audience. Number two, look at and listen to the performance. Yes, another seemingly simple step to ensure that you are, in fact, an audience member. But very often patrons forget to do this. Your focus and attention to the performance that is taking place will actually help you fully inhabit the experience. And afterwards, you will truly be able to say, I saw and heard this performance from start to finish. Which brings us to number three, turn off your fucking cell phone. Or at least set it to do not disturb. There is practically nothing you need to know absolutely right now during a performance that cannot wait the extra hour before the show is finished. Are you a surgeon who is on call? Is there a life or death situation that must be resolved with a phone call? If yes, then why are you at a show in the first place? Believe it or not, audiences have successfully watched performances without the interruption of cell phones for literally millennia. Why start now? Number four, shut the hell up while the performance is going on. Yes, it is a law of Newtonian physics that no two things can occupy the same space at the same time. Similarly, if the performance is meant to occupy the playing space and the focus of attention, then please don't try to compete with the performers. People pay good money to hear the performances, not your voice. Unless, of course, you are attending an interactive performance piece or an evening of stand-up comedy involving crowd work. Number five, don't be so wasted you can't even sit in a chair. That's right, if you're too chemically altered to attend a performance without puking in the seats or battling imaginary laser dragons, then maybe you should decide whether being a considerate audience member is a priority for you. Come back when it is. Yes, by following these easy steps, you'll be giving over your attention to a performance and respectfully allowing others to do the same. In doing so, you will allow yourself to have a much fuller experience, and if the performance is good, you will be that much more awestruck. If it's bad, at least you'll know exactly why, having paid attention the whole time. Thank you for being an audience member! All right, I'd like to talk directly to the artists who might be listening out there. Dear artists, you are creators, yes? But is the source of your art solely your own? Creation flows through you, and you direct it, but does anyone truly make something from nothing? Aren't you in awe of your own ideas sometimes? Isn't it fascinating to see your process unfold before you in ways you might not have even expected? Where does it all come from? I believe that awe for the artist is most strongly experienced during the creative process as inspiration. You can experience it afterwards as pride in your accomplishments, gratitude for all the help, or even self-admiration. But this being Neo-Bohemia, my emphasis is on process, so I want to examine the most likely form of awe that an artist feels during that phase, which I believe is inspiration. I think the experience of awe as inspiration for the artist was most fully illustrated early on in the concept of the muse. In Greek mythology, and then Roman, muses were goddesses who served as the source of knowledge and the embodiment of various arts at the time, such as poetry, music, dance, even comedy, and so forth. These goddesses would deign to give inspiration to mortal artists who then made great works of art because they were, quote, touched by the muse. Because of this, artists often sought to invoke the muse, first as an actual religious rite, and then later as a more secular tradition. There are famous invocations to the muse written in the prefaces of Homer's Odyssey, Virgil's Aeneid, Ovid's Metamorphoses, Dante's Inferno, Chaucer's Troilus and Cressida, Shakespeare's Henry V, "Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention," and Milton's Paradise Lost. So it seemed to work for them. There were also cult practices of muse worship, where Greeks built shrines to them and filled them with art, which is how we get our earliest museums. And so much since then has been written, composed, sung, painted, sculpted, danced, etc., about the muses for centuries. And what I'm trying to get at is the possibility that the awe in art, felt by audience and artist alike, might come from a divine creativity and a godlike mastery inspired by these muses. Also, similar to mythology, it's clear that there's always been a long-standing connection between art and religion/spirituality. There are many religions, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, etc., and there's so much artwork inspired by them, ranging from the Sistine Chapel to the pyramids. But the very first known works of art on Earth are also believed to be somewhat religious and spiritual, even though they predate all of these religions. According to archaeologists, there is some prehistoric art that dates as far back as 35 to 40,000 years ago. It's called parietal art, and it was made on cave walls, sometimes the ceiling, and on large blocks of stone. The oldest known cave wall paintings were a red disc found in Spain and a hand stencil in Indonesia. Remember when you drew an outline of your hand as a Thanksgiving turkey in kindergarten? You were actually connecting to a timeless tradition that spans ages. And speaking of, the most common subject of the wall paintings from this time period appeared to be animals, presumably that were hunted. Bison, horses, aurochs, deer, and maybe even turkeys, though probably not. But they weren't just decorations. Some theorists proposed they were informational, documenting the hunts, animal migration patterns, etc., but others have interpreted them to be mystical and spiritual expressions. They could have been animistic totems or works of hunter magic to increase the number of kills, or sympathetic magic, and this is my favorite theory from David Lewis Williams, where you have these Cro-Magnon shamans who would go deep into the cave, enter a trance, draw their power from the cave walls themselves, and then paint the visions they saw. Now that's another type of artistic inspiration altogether. And this is a type of process you can trace to modern day, in which artists go deep within themselves and search the subconscious, the collective unconscious, or even the great beyond to find the image, the idea, the inspiration for their art. This reminds me of filmmaker David Lynch and his 40-plus year commitment to transcendental meditation. In his book Catching the Big Fish, Meditation, Consciousness, and Creativity, David Lynch advocates meditation as a means of expanding consciousness, to expand one's artistic capacity. He writes, and I have to use his voice for the full effect, so here goes. Ideas are like fish. If you want to catch little fish, you can stay in the shallow water. But if you want to catch the big fish, you've got to go deeper. Down deep, the fish are more powerful and more pure. They're huge and abstract, and they're very beautiful. All right, thank you for indulging me. So, if it isn't a touch by the muse, or if it isn't God with a capital G, Zeus, Jove, Jesus, Allah, Buddha, Brahma, and all the rest, then similar to that of the shaman's trance, maybe the inspiration comes from a very deep consciousness. Wherever it comes from, inspiration has sparked awe in artists since they could paint on walls. Hi everyone, guess what? I have stickers! Woo! They finally arrived. 4x4-inch vinyl stickers of the Pizza Rat Crest logo, beautifully designed by the brilliant Anna Lansden, and I'm giving them away. If you want one, all you have to do is share one of my episodes on your Facebook thread, or email it to a friend, or give me a positive rating on iTunes. After that, message me directly on Facebook or the Neo Bohemia Facebook page, and I'll send you a sticker as soon as I can. This offer is only good for 2016, so act fast-ish. Thanks, everybody, and now back to our program. Welcome back. I would like to take this time to offer some advice to the romantics out there from my own personal experience. Please don't mistake awe for love. It's hard to tell the difference sometimes because the feelings can be very similar, but for your own safety, learn to distinguish when it's love and when it's just infatuation. Personally, I've only ever fell in love with artists of one sort or another, and that's true, by the way. And that type of initial allure is seductive, charming, mysterious, and beguiling all at once. You can see a piece of art or a performance that is so good and you can be so impressed that you just want to love it. So you think, why not go to the source? But art and artist are not one and the same. Sometimes the art is the very best part of the person who makes it. And if that's all you see or are willing to see, then you're not looking at a complete human being. And if you're only loving the best part of a person, you're ignoring all the other parts you don't like, or that don't suit you, that aren't as easy to acknowledge, accept, and embrace. It's easy to fall in love with a good artist. It's harder to love the complete person, all the parts. You can be in awe of a performer or an artist and their work. You can express an appreciation for it, even a longing-lasting admiration. You can bring them flowers on opening night and offer other gestures of gratitude, and feel special as though you know a secret the rest of the world doesn't. You can get close, so intimately close with an artist and all the brilliance, but you can't call it love until you are close enough to see each part of that person. And celebrate it all like it's the best work of art you've ever seen. Now, in this regard, I think I was very fortunate to fall in love with my wife before I became so wonderstruck with her as a performer. And I will leave you listeners to wonder what type of performance she does. I'm not going to say. I didn't fully see her as a performer first. I saw her as a person, and that was enough. I was hooked. I wanted to get to know her in that way first because I didn't want to project some unrealistic fantasy that would deteriorate into a disappointing reality. So I learned all about her realities first, and luckily they were fascinating enough to me, and I was still into her. And then later on, when I was ready and mentally prepared to not get too swept away, I saw her perform. And that was a really surprising experience. To see an artist make great art and to know that you love her both for that and then all the other more normal reasons is a truly fulfilling experience. And I'm not saying any of this to gloat about her, but to highlight an important distinction. The awe that I have for her as an artist and a performer is not infatuation the way it had been before for me. This is like transcendence. And I have to say, I don't think it's just because I'm already in love with her as a person. I genuinely believe that if I didn't know her at all and was watching her perform, it would be an uplifting experience, independent of romance, fantasy, and emotion. A tour guide for the Grand Canyon once told me how much he enjoyed watching people's personalities change when they look out into all of that expanse. And it's sort of like that in a way. The thing is, I don't even see her as myself. It's not infatuation or amorous longing. It's not even sexual, which I found surprising. When I see her perform, it's no longer me, Charlie, watching Rachel, my wife. It's me and her and everyone else, and everything just is. But here's the problem. You can get that kind of high from an awesome piece of art or a performance, and then make it the standard by which you hold other pieces and performances. But every experience is different and unique, or it ought to be, and I truly believe that part of inviting awe into each new experience is allowing it to be somehow new to you every time. This goes back to the idea of beginner's mind that I like so much. And if everything seems old hat and familiar, then maybe you should focus on what's different this time, what is uncertain and unknown in this exact experience. And I recommend this to audience and artists alike. The problem is you might start comparing this performance to that one, this gallery to that, and you might start ranking things based on value. And if you do so, you are bound to have an experience that pales in comparison to previous ones. And I confess, I do it. Sometimes I compare experiences, and it affects my ability to see something truly as a new thing. For instance, I saw Derek Jacobi play King Lear at BAM, and I reconciled in my mind that I don't need to see another King Lear in this lifetime, because I already hit the pinnacle. And it was a phenomenal King Lear, people. The clown was funny, the Edmund was even better than Jacobi. People in the audience were gasping at plot points they pretty much already knew. It was the Lear to end all others. But what if another King Lear comes along? Will I just say no? I saw Jacobi's Lear, cross it off the bucket list. What if I like the play so much because of that previous production, and I miss the awe and excitement I felt from Edmund's Bastard speech, and Lear in the storm, and the eye gouging? What if I need another hit? I don't have a video of Jacobi, and besides, it won't be the same. Video of live performance is a little hit or miss. So what if I go in for another production of King Lear? Do I have the strength of heart to risk my already perfect experience of King Lear for the possibility of disappointment? What if I'm just glorifying the performance I did see just to protect my feelings? Come to think of it, the Goneril lost her voice halfway through that night. I think I remember that. I could hear some disappointed gasps from the audience, like she wasn't giving her 100%, and her voice started to strain and crack, and she lost some volume and power. She faltered, and audiences can be super cruel, even when they're just reacting honestly to a performance. Hell, maybe she was sick and was doing her absolute best. Unfortunately, I can't always get to there with every piece of art that I experience. Sometimes things are just lost on me. I want to be open because I know how good it can feel. I know I'm not perfect. I lose patience. My mind wanders. I'm not looking closely enough, or my mind latches onto something I didn't like, and that prevents me from noticing all the rest. But I'm willing to keep on trying, and I hope everyone else is. I need to because I love when it works. It's so worthwhile. And so here are just a few examples of the times I've felt awe in art, from moments that inspired me, that kept me going, that made me realize that there is so much possibility in our world. And yes, sometimes when an artist does impress you, inspiration seems impossible. It can be daunting and disheartening if it makes you think that, oh, I'll never be able to do that ever in my life, and you feel limited and overpowered. But if you can let that sensation subside, rather than that, why not let the experience expand your notion of what we as a race of people are capable of doing as artists? And if this artist can do this great thing, imagine what you can do. Here are some moments. I saw Yayoi Kusama's retrospective at the Whitney in 2012. I didn't read about her life before I saw it, I just wanted to see the work first. And after an hour or so of being swept up by some of these most painstaking patterns, polka dots and oblong shapes, after attempting to fathom the infinity of fireflies on the water, that room with all the mirrors, I wondered in amazement to myself, what kind of person has the patience to arrange these little intricate patterns, less exact than a fractal, and somewhat more personal and unique because of it, and that they're so detailed, you'd think it was printed out on a computer, except that you can see the stroke of a hand. Who could possibly be able to do that? I'll tell you who, answered the biographical placard. Someone who's been dealing with obsessive-compulsive disorder and hallucinations all of her long life, and is working through it and with it and from it. Someone who admitted herself into a mental hospital back in 1977 and has lived there since, but maintains a studio right nearby that is full of the work that stems from her neurological disease. And at that point, I was more awestruck by what seemed like a lifetime of precarious and daring self-management. This is a woman who lives right on her edge, and you see it. I saw the Jackson Pollocks at the MoMA when I was a late teen and was struck with such a visceral response. They made me hungry. The thick ribbons and puddles of oil and enamel reminded me of the most epic ice cream sundae pizza. The immensity of 1 No. 31, 1950 drew me like a tractor beam towards its lone standing wall. This is paint on a canvas. It's not anything else, and I had never thought of art in that way. It was jazz and improv dance and speaking in tongues, and I was mystified. And the textures, the thickness of the paint, and how did he get it to dry like that?
Excuse me, sir, please step back.
Oh, sorry. I was nearly close enough to eat the thing. I once visited the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg. Matisse, Degas, Rembrandt, and so very, very much more. Over 3 million works of art, in fact. Spread out over 233,000 square meters. Whew. But what struck me first was the entrance to the Winter Palace. The foyer was just jeweled opulence and golden everything. We followed a rich red carpet to a grand pair of doors that were shut, and the tour guide asked us, "So if you were a foreign dignitary or ambassador from another country, in what way could our National Museum make a strong impression on you?" And the next moment, the doors opened to a two-story tall hallway, a football field long, the walls of which were lined with rows upon rows of portraits of military officials. "With glory of Russian army!" he exclaimed, perhaps half-jokingly. But I was aghast. There must have been over 100 generals, captains, heroes of their land depicted here, all of whom fought against Napoleon's army in 1812. So much pride and glory on these walls. I then noticed every so often a portrait was missing, and in its place would be just an empty golden frame. The guide explained, "That is because sometimes our generals died in battle before they could have their portrait painted." Oh. Another time, I heard Verdi's Requiem at the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts in Philadelphia, and it was absolutely terrifying. Awe in the sense of sheer fear, intended as a fear of God, and just reveling in that panic. If you've ever heard the Dies Irae section live, it's quite possibly the loudest thing in the world. Imagine a full chorus screaming at you in Latin about the day of wrath and how great the terror will be when the judge smashes everything completely. And that drum, there's this bass drum, and it's like a shockwave. I was sitting towards the back, and I could still feel it in my chest. It was such a frenzy, I wanted to run out of the hall, clawing at my face and screaming bloody murder before the earth opened up and swallowed me in an ocean of molten brimstone. But I was sitting in the middle of the row, so I thought better of it. No, actually, the loudest thing I've ever heard in my life were the times I saw bands like Bleach 03, Malt Banana, Pilander Z, or An Albatross play their noise rock, thrashcore, grindcore, applecore, whatever insanity they play at venues like The Knitting Factory, Arlene's Grocery, and CBGB's. Rest in peace. My buddy George would dress up in a Ghostbuster jumpsuit and film these weird loud bands sometimes, and I couldn't tell which was more impressive. The insane high-pitched screams coming out of these little Japanese girl trios, the veritable state of emergency mosh pit happening at the front of the stage, or that George could hold a camcorder pretty steadily amidst all of this riot. I saw this play called Snake Bit at the Grove Street Playhouse by the Naked Angels. This was my first experience in New York of tiny, intimate, off-off-Broadway theater. Just one small interior living room set with three actors talking about life and having fights and trying their best to work things out, and it really got to me in a way that I'd never seen theater before. I hadn't seen people so courageous enough to let the sheer simplicity of their performances just stand on its own. It was a real gamble, and it paid off. These actors are so natural and authentic on stage, and how do they do that? I had just seen Ragtime on Broadway the month before, and it's an amazing production, sure, but it wasn't intimate, not like this. And I thought, man, I could really get into this kind of thing. And I loved it so much, I saw it again in the same run. And then later, I saw a production by the same company, but because it was successful, they went bigger, and I felt like it didn't measure up to that first, more intimate performance. And I would say the same thing about Hedwig and the Angry Inch at the Jane Street Theater compared to the Belasco. And I know I'm biased, but it's a tough balance. The first Broadway show I ever saw, though, was Bringin' the Noise, Bringin' the Funk, and I was astounded. George C. Wolfe, Reggie Gaines, Anne Duquesne, and Savion Glover tell the story of black history in America from slavery to the then-present 1996 through tap dancing, hoofing, spoken word, drumming, and hip-hop. It was unlike any show I'd ever seen before or heard about, and certainly unlike most shows on Broadway at the time. And I gotta hand it to my dad for choosing that over Cats or Les Mis. It was a gutsy choice, and I appreciate that. But it was so spectacular and innovative, which I found out later as I watched other more formulaic shows, and it offered me a perspective that I just wasn't getting at that time in high school or film or TV, unfortunately. And it was also a trailblazer in the fusion of hip-hop and musical, if you look at it in the context of shows like In the Heights, Holla If You Hear Me, and now Hamilton, which came to Broadway 10 to 20 years later. All right, that's enough for now. If you made it all the way to the end, I'd like to thank you for your attentive listening. Finding the awe in art is important to me. It's important enough that I've been thinking about this for weeks now, and trying to investigate it, and understand it, and answer questions. And even if I only scratched the surface today, if I've only begun to discover what is awe-inspiring in art, then I'm happily resigned that there are plenty more stones to uncover. And I look forward to them. I do know that as an audience to art, we can foster a sense of awe by giving our focus to the performance or the piece that is being presented. We can strive to be open and emotionally available to the artist's expression in order to have a fuller experience, potentially a humbling one, and that we can also appreciate what goes into making art and remember that people are putting themselves out there every day. Putting up their money, their time and effort, and going out of their comfort zones just to have a chance to say something that they think is important, and to see if it resonates with you. And the fact that people have done this for ages, and we keep doing it, and we as audience keep seeking it out in the world for many reasons, for a communion, for an understanding, for a shared experience, or just to not feel alone for a little while, well, that makes me feel awe too. Thank you, everyone. I'm Charlie Layton, and this is Neo Bohemia.
Thank you.